Welcome to this edition of El Paso Primetime. On this Saturday at 1 o'clock, a production of KTEP, we hope you're having a great day. I'm Dennis Wu, sitting here with my co-host, who also happens to be the co-host to Science Studio, Russ Chianelli, top of the afternoon, actually. How are you?
I'm very excited about what we're going to do in a few minutes.
Exactly. We have two lovely ladies in the house. Chef Keely Cheshire.
<That's> now you right. have to go.
Yep, there you go.
Right.
Welcome back to El Paso Primetime.
Thanks for having me back. This is so exciting to come back, like, what is it, twice in 2 months or something? I'm feeling quite the celebrity around here.
Good deal. You should be coming back more often, actually. We'll
is
talk to
your agent standing outside
right,
the door?
Yes, that's the one. He'll be billing you later.
and your other agent is also your friend in literary crime, as it were, although this is not a criminal – well, it's a criminal – sort of book in a certain sort of way. Rebecca Jean Downey joins us now at El Paso Primetime, a brand new book called The Middle Eye. Welcome to El Paso Primetime.
Thank you very much. I'm just thrilled to be here. I really am.
And also, Rebecca, one of the things I wanted to know before we get into the book, you're also working here at UTEP for expanding mm-hmm. our future. Tell us a bit about that,
exactly.
Please.
I've been in the development office for the last 5 years, 6 years. Working with development officers on raising funds for the National Research University and our capital campaign that we're doing.
Tier 1,
yes. And we're getting really, really close to meeting our goal.
I know. Mm-hmm. That's why all of us who are working mm-hmm. in the research mm-hmm. area, you know, get whipped every day if we don't get another $10.
you better write another grant, right?
Another grant. Mm-hmm. Okay, tell us, please, and we're going to get into your book, that we know that Keely is an old friend,
yes.
a young old friend.
Thank you for that, Russ. No, actually, I'm going to just throw this in here. Back in 2002, when I was just kind of getting into the culinary scene and trying sort of experimenting and seeing if anybody was actually interested in buying my food, Becky was the first person ever to have that kind of confidence and say, you know what, my daughter's going to get married. I'm going to have you throw the engagement party. And so my first paid experience was actually with Becky. So, you know, that's a lot to say for me, because look where I am now.
Do you remember the first thing that she made for you?
Well, I do remember, because it was salmon. It was fabulous. And asparagus, and everybody loved it.
We had a lot of fun.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
It was a lot of fun. But I remember that because, I mean, everyone's like, yeah, come up to our house and cook and do this. No one actually wanted to pay. And I was like, no, I need to actually get into this as a profession. And so Becky, you know, she trusted me and she had faith and she gave me that possibility and many more to follow, because then she got me in the TV with Felipe Solis. And so we did many things together after that. So it was a lot of fun.
I mean, you had to get paid. You were tired of riding around in the rain shooting the cows yourself.
I was. I was sick of people lighting up at my door.
Well, Rebecca, this looks very exciting. Could you tell us a little bit about your new book, The Middle Eye?
Well, thank you. Well, basically, I wanted to just back up and tell you that I work on the 7th floor of Kelly Hall, and my office used to be looking out onto Ciudad Juarez. Mm-hmm. And it was at the height of the violence, and I used to just worry. I'd watch people coming and going to their work, and I knew they were struggling, and so many of them, they just had no out. And I began to think, what could I do? What could I write about? And that's how it started. And then I discovered that 20,000 children are kidnapped every year in Mexico, and about half of those are sold into the slave trades. And that's not acceptable.
You know, I know I used to have an office that looked over there mm-hmm. all the time, too, and it really is something that really moves you. And I worked on something called Materials Corridor, which was supposed to help the border, and that's a different story. But tell us a little bit about, when you talk about a slave mm-hmm. trade, I know what you mean, or I think mm-hmm. the audience knows what you mean, but is that a slave trade that's coming into the U.S. or going somewhere else?
Actually, Mexico has the distinguished honor of having a south border where slavery is imported. And then they have a business that is actually stationary in Mexico that also perpetuates it. And then we have the export of slave trade. So they have that dubious honor of a trio of issues.
Yeah, I know there was, I don't remember her name, but there was a woman that was riding the train all the way from the southern border to the northern border, and all the different things that were going on, the trades and so on and so forth. Do you remember her name?
I don't. But I do know there is an organization called Southwest Key. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but they're anticipating that there will be 20,000 unaccompanied minors coming over the border in 2013 because of the state of the South American economy, particularly Honduras, which is in the state of chaos.
There is a motion picture called Sin Nombre that came out in 2006 that kind of chronicles, Russ, what you were talking about, Becky. Mm-hmm. That it's the sort of thing that kind of makes you wonder why mainstream America doesn't know about that still.
Because everybody's in denial.
That's what I think, and yeah. I agree with Keeley.
What people didn't realize, which surprised me, that movie, I think this woman I was talking about was involved, was that there's actually a trade where the people come from Guatemala, and then some people help them on top of the trains, and they have to pay with their trade on the way up to get into the U.S.
Yes.
So it's getting people from Central America into the U.S. through Mexico.
Right. Well, and now those are children, because the adults have abandoned their children. Not every person, but in South America, they've abandoned their children, and the children go off trying to find them. So they strap themselves to a train, and they proceed to come north. And along the way, things can happen to them, and they're not good.
Which kind of brings us to your book, The Middle Eye. This is a very unique thriller because its setting is so close to home.
Right. Right. It is. What happened was I was trying to find a way. I don't know how many of you read a lot of mysteries, but I was kind of a mystery junkie. And I was upset, like, when somebody was like an undertaker and they suddenly became a private investigator. I could never figure out the connection with those. And I thought, what kind of a person could I develop? What kind of protagonist could I develop? And Penny Larkin is a remote viewer, a controlled remote viewer. And she takes classes in Alamogordo, where there is actually classes being held. And the controlled remote viewing was developed by the CIA back in the 70s, because the CIA was convinced that Russia was spying on us psychically. And so they had, for about 15, 20 years, they had a psychic spying program called Stargate. It was developed by Stanford University. Mm-hmm. And so I have her gaining those kinds of skills, and that helps her to solve the mystery of a little 11-year-old girl that's kidnapped in Alameda Park.
So we don't want to give it away, but you sort of said that she did solve the issue. But you have to read the book.
No, we have to read the one after.
I do have a sequel. But I think that she was able to use it. She doesn't consider herself psychic. And the sheriff's office hires her. I was inspired by Leo Samaniego when I was a freelance writer. He opened both jails to me. I was legally there. And I was able to see all the things that he had accomplished. And it was so inspirational to me that I use him. He is the co-protagonist, and I call him Leo also, but a much younger version. And together, he hires her to try to help, because this is the second time that little Rosa has been kidnapped. And the FBI just thinks she's a runaway. But the sheriff does not.
An interesting way to set the scene for this is having this child kidnapped in Alamogordo at a linear park. For those who've never been there, all you need to do is just take 54 into Alamogordo, go past two lights, and all of a sudden over to your left is Alameda Park. There's a zoo, and it's linear. It goes for maybe about 3 miles. And it's a really nice place to be. But the way that you set the scene up now involves the entire Desert Southwest.
Exactly. What I discovered when I was doing my research was that the unfortunately, different mobs, different organized criminals are in Mexico, and they found out that the $32 billion slave trade was something they wanted to get into. And they are in it, and I happen to use Russians in this case, but I think the Koreans are there. A very great number of different organized criminal networks are there.
Well, when you came up with this idea, what made you pick Alamogordo?
I mean, well, Alamogordo is where they right now they train controlled remote viewers.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. So there's – I see.
Right.
Okay.
But do our listeners know what controlled remote viewers are?
Probably
good
not.
Question.
Good question.
That's a very good point. Controlled remote viewing is something that they believe and the ARMA believe that just about any – we all have the capacity to see beyond what is right in front of us. And if you use a series of protocols to quiet your mind and focus your mind, that you can indeed see what needs to be seen. And they use what they call
targets. So this is a psychic tool. That's why we looked.
It is, I guess, a psychic tool, if you wish to call it that. Penny is very – she doesn't like that. She doesn't like to be called a psychic. And it gets her upset in
it's
the book.
It's not something the IRS is using, is it?
Well, that's possible. I don't know. That would have been handy, wouldn't it? And she gets her feathers ruffled because one of the deputies, the one that's to do the sketch of who she sees, he says, oh, you know what, I can't wait to tell my friends I met somebody who sees dead people. And it really made her angry. Okay. So, you know, she doesn't think of it as psychic. She thinks we're all like
able
that.
To do that.
That's
it's just
right.
Maybe an underdeveloped talent.
Exactly.
So you said also that you were a freelance writer before. What does that mean?
I was. I've been writing all my life. You know, when I graduated from college in journalism, my dad took me aside and said, I don't know how you're going to make a living. You should have been a teacher or a nurse. How are you going to be a writer? But I've been paid to be a writer all my life. And I have, when I moved to El Paso from Indiana, I started freelancing. And I've freelanced for El Paso Inc. I freelanced for a lot of law enforcement journals and magazines, and that's where I wrote an article about Leo Samaniego and his department. He was considered at the time one of the finest law enforcement officers in the country.
Right.
And so, and then I had the privilege of interviewing Harley Lappin, who was the warden of the Terre Haute Federal Prison when Timothy McVeigh was executed. And what little story that was not told was 8 days later, Raul Garcia, who was a drug cartel boss, was executed. And nobody showed up for that one. So I was very curious as to what the warden did, how he dealt with it, and how the federal government deals with it. Because I was sure, since it was right after 9/11, I was sure that we were going to have more and more executions. But that hasn't been the case.
Do you think more and more it's about a cosmetic cleansing of an execution policy within the federal prison system?
You know, I don't really know. The last execution before Timothy McVeigh was a man, I forget his name, he was hung in Iowa, and that was in 1963. So we don't execute folks. And so I wasn't anticipating when the bombing came with Joe Carr came up in Boston. I don't anticipate any time soon.
Well, haven't we executed some people recently in Texas?
Yeah, Texas has 18.
But this is federal.
Yeah, federal.
We're talking about federal.
Federal.
Okay. The federal government is, you know, they really aren't into that. And so, but I didn't think it, you know, when I interviewed.
So for treason, for example, which is in the Constitution a death penalty, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you know, I really did expect it, you know, right after 9/11, and we were all on fire, and but didn't happen. And so, you know, I was just totally wanting to know how the federal government did this and what they did and how – because what – you know, so many places where there's executions, like in Huntsville, there's not – they're sort of out of the way.
Right.
And it doesn't impact communities. But in Terre Haute, they've made an industry out of the prison – federal prison system.
Mm-hmm.
And so these guards go home at night. And so everybody knows. The children know. And I was very, very concerned about the children, what kind of impact this had on them, what happened, you know, the Chamber of Commerce. And, you know, I was just very curious about that, and that's why I interviewed Harley Lappin.
It's a curious thing because I remember going to Florence, Colorado, because all of the room – I went to Florence, Colorado for an overnight stay simply because there were no rooms available in Colorado Springs and Pueblo because of the Olympic trials. So I wound up in Florence in the middle of the night, got a nice little room at a Super 8. Me and my mom, we stayed. Wake up in the morning, open up the curtain, and lo and behold, a federal prison with tons and tons of people on death row.
Oh,
and
no.
I thought, holy cow, what is that? And the hotel clerk said, oh, yeah, that's our cottage industry.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, it's clean.
Uh-huh.
You get professionals with the, you know, the guards, the educators, the tutors, the cooks. And, you know, it's a clean industry. So, you know, you can see why people want it.
So let's get back, because I know that people out there are interested. The Middle Eye is going to be released
July 2nd.
July 2nd.
Right. You can pre-order it now if you went to Barnes & Noble or if you go to Amazon, and you can pre-order it, and then it'll be delivered to your door.
So I know that a lot of us, myself included, would love to be able to write. How do we get discipline? How did you do it?
Well, because I write all day, at lunch hour, I went to the library, UTEP Library, and I worked for an hour every day for 3 years. And my book is, part of it is dedicated to Frances Lura, the woman who runs the coffee shop at the library, because she kept me going. Mm-hmm. And she said, I know people say, oh, it's so easy to write a book, but I can say, I saw Becky every day for 3 years, you know, hammering away. And that's how I did it.
But, like, did you organize an outline first, and did you write, say, this chapter is going to be this, or did you just spew it out?
I always think that authors who say they outline are lying. I know that isn't the case. But the muse is the most amazing thing in the world. If you had the courage to sit down and start writing, the muse takes over. I'm really a believer in that.
And this started very early, back in elementary school, didn't it?
It did, yes. I say I was the geek that wrote everybody's poetry. When there was an assignment, oh, Becky will write your poetry. And I wrote everyone's everyone's poetry. So I've been writing a long time.
You know, it's interesting, though. You say you write all day and you write for lunch.
I do.
You know, a lot of us for lunch want to do something else than what we're doing all day.
Right. I love writing. I love it.
So when you get it to a certain point, did you have somebody edit it for you or help you? And
I had a coach, a writing coach, because I actually thought I knew how to write a book. Mm-hmm. And after she looked at it, you know, she chuckled. And then she said, I don't have to teach you to write, but I will teach you how to write a thriller. And her name is Lucia Zimitti, and she lives in Las Cruces, and she's awesome. And I wouldn't be where I am had she not helped me. And then I did send it to the creative director at Taylor University for editing, and he was the one that suggested that I pursue a publisher.
So you have a book in the works. You have mm-hmm. this book that's about mm-hmm. to come out in July, mm-hmm. and it's all for a very special cause.
Yes, I'm very excited. You know, one thing, when you discover something that's so horrid as child trafficking, a writer can just write, and that's about all you can do. And I discovered that there was a new agency that was just being established, the Paso del Norte Center of Hope, and John Martin is the executive director. And we are trying to, and I am not on the board, but I'm a cheerleader, to establish an agency that doesn't replicate what anybody else is doing, but partners with other agencies to when the person, is, like the FBI or the Border Patrol, finds a child or a family or whatever, that they can be helped. And we provide a safe haven for them. And then usually, unfortunately, some of the children are addicted to alcohol or drugs because that's how they control them. Mm. And we use the El Paso Child Guidance Center and the El Paso Center for Children. They're all helping.
When you say children, give us a span of ages that you're talking about.
Well, you know, it used to be that kids were 13, 14, but I do know that recently they found a 5-year-old girl hidden in the engine compartment of a car. So that's, I mean, it's horrid, unacceptable. And I want the community of El Paso to let the nation know that we won't tolerate it.
This show will be archived on KTEP.org for anyone in the world to access and download. And it's one of our ways to make sure that this doesn't happen. But there's so much that can be done legally. Why isn't it being done? Is it a political thing?
No, I don't really think so. I think where we are is where maybe 10 or 15 years ago AIDS was, or violence against women.
Denial.
We didn't want to talk about it. It's so painful.
Mm-hmm. And especially also, I think my children are concerned.
Yes.
Because as a mother, mm-hmm. you know, I know Becky's too. When you raise your children and you keep them in this safe haven and then you hear about all these horrible things that can possibly – you know, happen to the kids, you just don't want to have anything to do with that because it's something that you want to live in denial of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
So I think that's what's happened.
I would say that the FBI, the Border Patrol, all of the agencies are working hard to try to contain it.
And it seems to me that there's another aspect mm-hmm. to it, and that is the economic poverty, which is making people do things that we wouldn't think of doing at this table because of that.
Yes. Yes, and I do have a character in my book, Dr. Jonathan Marquez, and he is a doctor in Juarez, and he's one of my favorites. And he gets involved because he's so desperate to get out of town. He wants to get out of the country.
And so you have to get out of the country, and that means that you do just about anything that's asked.
I just want people to think about who they are and what it would take for you to change your moral or ethical standards.
Mm-hmm.
How desperate would you have to get?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good mm-hmm. question. I mean, that's something that makes the reading of the middle eye something that we all should do, because I think those of us who are here on the border looking out at Juarez, and even now, you know, we used to go over to Juarez practically every week for something, and with all that violence, you know, the place is just dying. It looks to me like half of it's abandoned.
I think it's turning around a bit. I do. I think there's hope. The people of Juarez are so amazing, and they're resilient, and I have every confidence.
New government top to bottom. And,
exactly.
And I think that economic poverty you speak about mm-hmm. may turn a corner within the next 5 years. You hope for the best.
Exactly.
But one of the things that brings me right back to that question again is, with all of these governmental agencies, all these law enforcement agents that are trying their best in order to try to stem the tide of human trafficking, period, why it hasn't been more illuminated in the public eye? You know, it's one thing to mm-hmm. serve as a law enforcement officer and fight for the right. But there's another thing to illuminate the public and say, look, stand up and let's save these folks.
And I think that's where we are, don't you, Kaylee?
Yeah. You know, this is a silly thing, but have you ever walked into Walmart and seen the wall of missing children?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever stopped to really look?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. Well, I'm one of the rare ones.
I was going to say, you're probably one of the 10%. Because the rest of us just carry on with our day. It's denial. We don't want to see those little faces looking back at us. And we don't want to imagine what can possibly be going on with those people.
So. I do, before we close, did want to mention Sheriff Wiles, because he is going to be the law enforcement arm of this program. He has stepped forward, his group. And I find that really great, since I use the sheriff's office in the book.
You know, the character of Leo in this book strikes home to me because he is my uncle by marriage.
Oh my God.
Leo Samaniego is an uncle of mine marriage, and so it's an incredible sort of a thing. And then Sheriff Wiles has been such a friend to this radio station and to us here. I mean, it's just having him on the staff mm-hmm. is just wonderful.
Well, we're so appreciative of him. And that is why Paso de Norte is able to actually be established, because you did need to have a law enforcement agency involved, and the Sheriff's Department has done so.
How do people get involved seriously? I mean, from a either an economic standpoint or volunteer standpoint in getting involved with the Paso del Norte Center of Hope.
We're going to be having a launch of both the book and the agency at Italian's Restaurant on Monday the 24th. They could attend. It is a fundraiser. It's $100, but we're trying to establish the agency and get it on its feet.
And it's going to be a fun night, by the way.
I mean, cool.
It is, because Becky's going to be there. You're going to be reading a chapter.
I am going to read a chapter. Yes.
And so you get the book. She's going to sign it. We have a live auction with Victoria.
Mm-hmm. Victoria Gutierrez.
And so I think it's going to be a fun
night. And Hal Marcus is donating the artwork.
Yes.
So it should be a beautiful evening. And also
it's Monday.
Monday
this coming Monday.
Starting at?
At 6:30 to 9. At Italians.
And you can come and purchase tickets at Italians. We do have tickets, so if anyone's interested, I'd be more than happy to help you out. But it's going to be a fun night.
What about T-shirts?
Russ, we have some T-shirts.
I guess the T-shirt is next. But also on Facebook, the Paso del Norte Center of Hope has a page, and there's so much information out there now on trafficking. Before, all we heard about was Seoul and Mumbai and stuff, and it didn't relate to it. It didn't resonate with us.
Right.
And now it needs to.
Yeah, I agree 100%, simply because from the time that I saw Sin Nombre to this point in time, I've often wondered why El Paso doesn't have something like that, and now we do. It's very important. By the way, Keeley, is Double Trouble coming to the show? I got to give these guys from 92 a shout out, just so they say that I ignore them on public radio.
They're going to call me a traitor, you know that.
Well, have them call me on the request line they thought we didn't have.
I will. So Jojo and Sarge give you a call.
There you go. Very nice. Very nice. You know, there's so much to talk about. Let's go ahead and go over that night one more time, since it's coming up so quickly.
It's Monday, June 24th, from 6:30 to 9. It's at Italians, and the address is
5380 North Mesa.
And it is $100, but, you know, that is tax deductible. Come on in, and I think we'll probably still have room. Right now we have about 60 reservations, and mm-hmm. I think you hold 80, so there's still some spaces.
It's a great cause. And it's local. You know, we're supporting mm-hmm. something local, and I think that's so important. That's something that I want to get very much involved in, is supporting local businesses, charities, and it's all going to stay here. And it's going to be fun for those people from El Paso, I mean, in the sense that they read the book and they're going to recognize every street, every park.
I have had some feedback on that. And the last thing I would say, besides thank you so much for letting me share this time and being with Keeley, too, I just wanted to let you know that be on the lookout for these children.
Mm-hmm.
Because El Paso and I-10 is a transit point, one of the two or three transit points in from Mexico. So be on the lookout.
There are three corridors to be looking out for. 62-180 to Carlsbad, 54 going to Alamogordo, and I-10, and even Highway 28 heading to Cruces. If you can, be on the lookout, because those are the major corridors where everything happens, everything takes place. Just use your eyes and 911.
Yes, yes. Thank you guys so much. And thank you, Keeley.
Thank you, guys.
Russ, we're good.
We're finished, yeah. I can't wait for the sequel.
Well, it's about gun trafficking.
It's not about Fast and Furious, is it?
My lips are sealed.
Well, it's a great pleasure to have you both here.
Thank you,
Keeley,
for having
Cheshire.
Us, Rose. It's always a pleasure.
Okay, and Rebecca, Jean, Downey, thank you so much. And yes, if you have any suggestions for us to do more of this, because I know this is a subject that really has lots of zigs and zags.
I'm sure John Martin would love to come on and tell you about what his agency is doing and the partnerships he's developed.
We'd love to have him.
With the other agencies in town.
And we'd love to have all of you back. Mikasa Sukasa.
Thank you, Dennis. It's always a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to this edition of El Paso Primetime.